My name is Rob Auchincloss, and this is the Holocene Podcast, where we seek knowledge from those creative, adventurous, and bright among us. These individuals are storytellers, entrepreneurs, athletes, designers, and everything else in between. It is my job as the host to take what they have each learned in their own lives and codify their knowledge so that you can use their lessons in your own life. Today's episode is sponsored by the Holocene Magazine. You can order issue 1 online now, and you can pre-order issue 2, which will be coming out very, very soon. Today, I am joined by Max Weider. Max is not just a seasoned system engineer, project manager, innovator, and leader, but a devoted family man who seamlessly balances his professional expertise with a rich personal life. Holding 2 engineering degrees from Johns Hopkins University, Max has excelled at taking the impossible and making it possible. As chief executive officer and co-founder of Celsi for nearly 6 years, he demonstrates exceptional leadership. He has taken what was just a thought and turned it into a kitchen appliance of the future. Simultaneously, during his 7+ years at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory, Max has undertaken key responsibilities in making sure NASA's Europa Clipper project will get to Jupiter on time. Outside of his thriving career, Max enjoys quality time with his 3 kids and their family dog, adding a delightful balance to his life. Max's career and life are characterized by on-time deliveries, innovative solutions, and a commitment to excellence, establishing him as a highly skilled professional who cherishes both his work and family life. And so our discussions range on NASA to Legos to all about this new company and new product that he's been working on for quite some time. So without further ado, here's the conversation between myself and Max Weider.
Life is either an incredible adventure or it's nothing at all.
Max, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I start off every podcast by asking the same question, which is, what is the first thing you think about when you wake up in the morning?
Why do I have to get up? No, I work a 9-to-5 on top of my startup. So, you know, I'm putting in 80 hours a week or so, plus I have 3 kids and a dog, and there's just no downtime. So every time I wake up at 7:30 in the morning, I'm just like, okay, start it all over again. Like, let's do it.
Do you have any kind of, you know, morning routine to, simplify the chaos, maybe, especially with 3 kids and a dog and multiple jobs and email streams, I'm sure.
I want to say yes. It's really get out of bed and just get in the shower. Let the steam clear your head of the morning fog. That's kind of the first thing. And then look at the calendar and see what's on the agenda for today.
That makes sense. Do you have any kind of meditation or journaling, or maybe it's a ritual involving like a coffee or tea or anything like that, or exercise?
I wish I had time for exercise. I used to run marathons 10 years ago. Haven't had a chance recently. The morning coffee helps, with breakfast and everything like that. But really the morning routine is just get up, get in the shower and get started, right? It's the daily grind. Sure. I want to say people should make sure they have time for self-care and meditation and things like that. And luckily for me, my startup, I enjoy it a lot. So that is my self-care. So really when I wake up, it's let's knock out the things I have to do every day so that I can get to the things that I want to do.
Yes. I love that. Interesting. So how do you currently balance your time between your 9-to-5 and your startup? I'm guessing it's probably that, you know, the 9-to-5 comes first from a time perspective, but sometimes there are priorities with the startup that may supersede some of those and you kind of flip them in and out like a checkerboard kind of.
Yeah. So I'm a government contractor. I work from home. So I have flexibility, right? If I have a meeting that comes up with a potential investor or a potential partner in the middle of the day, I stretch my hours and work longer on the 9-to-5 after that. It's nice like that, but, a lot of what I'm doing, cause we're not in market yet per se, is R&D and networking. And with the R&D, I can work whatever hours I want, which is nice.
Sure.
So just before we kind of dive into, you know, your pedigree and what the product is, you're incubating a startup and everything else, I think it's important to kind of paint the picture for the audience, which is, you know, kind of your background and what you spend your time doing. So how would you describe the work that you do now to your 8-year-old self?
I sit in a chair on a computer. I work for NASA, as a contractor at a third party organization, and I do system design, verification, and project management, for interplanetary missions for NASA. So, the last 8 years I've been working on a probe that's going to launch next year for Jupiter. The last 3 years I've been working on a probe that's going to measure how our entire solar system flies through interstellar space within our solar system, within our galaxy, and our sun essentially protects our solar system and things like that. I don't even know the science really, right? Because the scientists that create the instruments, I'm just the engineer, who cares to make sure it works. That's kind of what I do on a daily basis.
And for this NASA probe, is it through a specific NASA facility or vertical or unit? Like, who is your kind of your technical NASA overreaching boss, I should say?
Yeah. So for the Jupiter probe, that goes through JPL. They're the prime on that. So actually, we've delivered our hardware to them. I'm doing like final closeout of our hardware that's out there, you know, final solar arrays coming from international partners, final parts that just arrived at our facility for checkout that are getting delivered to JPL. And that's going to get moved over to the Cape in the next couple months for getting loaded up onto the rocket. For the other one, my company was actually the prime on it. So we put in the proposal to NASA and we got the direct mission. So we are the head mission operations on that probe.
That's awesome. Yeah, I have a couple friends at JPL, so I was just curious. It felt like a JPL mission. So that was And I think I've heard of this. So I should, after this, I'll look to see if any of my friends are working on the JPL side. Maybe you know them, which would be fun. So when you say your company is kind of leading this charge, is this a company you started as well, or a company you work for as a contractor to NASA, or?
Yeah, so it's a university affiliated research lab, otherwise known as a UARC, which is what JPL is essentially. And so we are associated with Johns Hopkins University. You know, they've been around for 1940s. They well established, almost 10,000 employees. You know, I don't want to call it a cog in the machine, right? It's a well-oiled machine that has its bureaucracy, its government partners, it gets its contracts.
Yeah.
You know, it is a well-established partner with the U.S. government. They are a trusted agent to make sure that technology is developed in a sustainable might not be the right word, but in a good way, the best way for our government, right? So essentially, the government says, we have this idea. They come to a place it's the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab. They come to us. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time what we do is we do the science experiment to prove out the technology. And then we join the government team to oversee the contractor who actually develops it. That's the bulk of what we do. But in the space group, we actually work as like a space company. So underneath the umbrella of the 10,000 employees is roughly 1,000 of them in the space department, where we put proposals together. We work on the decadal studies that come out once every 10 years, and we propose science missions, and we come up with innovative ways to do it with cool new science or more affordably, things like that. You may have heard of the Parker Solar Probe. It's the one that's flying essentially into the sun. That came out of us, and it took 10 years or so, because we actually developed a new material, a new carbon material to protect the probe from the sun. Yeah.
Interesting. Is it like a
Oh, don't know. I will not know the answer to this question.
Got it. Okay. Let's get super nerdy for a second. So I was going to ask, because that was one of my focus areas of research and study when I was in school. It was basically between composites and regenerative cooling for liquid rocket engines, or like my two kind of.
No, this is a super thick shield.
That's awesome.
Basically, the bulk of it. I actually had a friend who was an intern when we were at college working on it. He actually works at the spaceship company now, over in the Mojave Desert.
Yeah, no, they're cool, and their headquarters out in Mojave are awesome. Right, it's like you couldn't ask for a cooler place to go to work. It's in the middle of nowhere, right? You're near nothing, right? But it is beautiful. So you did. I was just taking a brief look at your LinkedIn. You did. You went to Johns Hopkins for undergrad and grad, and then is that how you found out about this opportunity and kind of just stayed along, or did you go elsewhere and come back?
No, wish I did. When I graduated, it was 2011 for my undergrad, which if you look at historical numbers, was the absolute worst time ever to graduate as an aerospace engineer. What I did the summer after I graduated was I went and I watched the last space shuttle launch, which was then preceded with NASA laying off 2,000 aerospace engineers that flooded the market across everything.
Yeah.
And these are very experienced engineers because it was the end of an era. So I went and got my master's almost as like a time gap to help myself compete with the now flooded market.
Not a bad use of time, you know?
Yeah. And from there, I was unemployed right out of college, right? I was living in my parents' basement, applying to like 500 jobs a day where I copy and pasted my resume onto an online platform that just told me to upload my resume, that type of just burning through the midnight oil of applying.
And can I say that for some reason, the aerospace job platforms are the worst, right? Like you can apply to 685 roles at Boeing and you might get one email back 2 years later saying you didn't get one of the jobs and you'll never hear about any of them ever. Like, it's awful. Like no other industry like that. Just for people out there that are curious, sorry for interrupting you, but like, yeah, it's the worst job searching process is aerospace by far. Continue. Yeah. Sorry.
I know. And what's worse is after you go into the industry, you learn that in order to get the job, you talk to someone, they open a job rec for you, and then you get hired into the job rec.
Yeah.
So even though it's there and I applied to it, they have no intention of hiring you. So every job rec that you see on those platforms is basically already accounted for, which is, it's difficult. That's how – yeah. So I luckily knew someone at a small company called AAI, which did unmanned aircrafts for the military. Mm-hmm. They got acquired by Textron Systems, which, owns a bunch of other people, including Bell and Cessna. Yeah. And so that's how I got my in. And then once I had that, I gained the experience, right? So it's that first job.
Put you have in to your get time. Into. Yeah.
Yeah. So, And so that was a very fruitful 3.5 years, and it gave me the skill set I needed to move over to the Hopkins Applied Physics Lab to work in space, because I didn't want to work on manned aircrafts. I didn't want to work in military. I wanted to do space systems. And I made sure that the job I worked taught me the necessary skills that could easily translate over to what I ultimately wanted to do.
Yeah. And is that ultimately what you want to do more in line with what you're doing now with your startup? Or
absolutely
what is what you ultimately
want
to do?
What I'm doing as a contractor for NASA is literally what I dreamed about doing from the day I was a kid, doing sci-fi and Lego and all that engineering stuff. Mm-hmm. My startup, honestly, it came out of left field. I didn't even know I wanted to do this until 6 years ago when, you have that spark concept, aha moment of this is a cool thing. And it becomes like your baby. Like when I started this, I had no children. I had just gotten married, and I'm like, this is awesome. Like, and it is my first child, basically. Watching it be born, take its first crawls, first steps to where it is now. And so it's just like there's something about that it's really hard to describe. Like, I literally committed my entire middle school, high school, college career to being an aerospace engineer. And then just out of left field, this startup comes along and you're somehow so much more passionate about it than you ever thought you could be. And it's such an odd feeling.
Weird.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, no, and I feel that because I, you know, you and I have, and I think this is why I think you and I become friends outside of this, which is because, you know, I'm someone that has an aerospace engineering background and always dreams of that, but went full on to the startup world. And I now just work with startups, some of my own, some of my friends, and sometimes it's aerospace, sometimes it's not, right? So, you know, kind of going back to what the question I asked you about, you know, describe what you do to your eight-year-old self, how would you describe that? Same question, but answer it in the startup aspect, right? Because I'm sure that your 8-year-old self sounded like a curious kid, right? So I'm sure they'd probably be like, "What else are you working on?" Right? So how would you answer that question for that?
So I kind of would flip the script, like, you know, I would say, you know, when I was 8 years old, I would get a Lego set, I'd build the Lego set, I'd destroy the Lego set, and then just start building whatever I wanted.
Good man.
That's kind of what the being in a startup feels like, is I'm getting to just freeform it and follow my own path. There's no directions. There's nothing like that. And I apologize for my children banging on the office door.
No, it's fine. I love it. It makes it feel real. I'm sure at this point people are like, okay, what is that startup, right? So I guess my question now to you is, like, how would you describe what the product is to someone listening? Like, what is the pitch?
Yeah, so the pitch to a consumer, which is always different than talking to an investor or a potential partner, is imagine if you had a robot at home that you controlled from your phone that let you peruse your fridge, put it to the oven, and cook it and have it just ready for you.
Yeah. Dive deeper. Like, tell me more. Right. Like, just say, like, I'm sold. Like, I'll give you the money, but like, where do I? Does it take? You know, I have many questions. Right. So this is, and I purposely didn't do research on the product on purpose because I wanted to have this discovery with you. As like, imagine we're sitting actually on a plane. We meet, and I don't have access to the internet. Imagine there's no Wi-Fi whatsoever, and I say, let's talk through this. Right. So, you know, does it use special kind of meal cartridges? Can you put in anything you want? Like, what is the timeline? Like, what is the ideal use case scenario? Like, is it going to save me money? Is it going to save me time? Is it both? Like, what does it do?
Yeah. You know? So what I found is the easiest thing to do is put analogies out there for how the system works based on real world examples. So the examples I will use are Keurig, Epson ink cartridges, Roomba, and Netflix.
Okay.
And so I'll dig into it. So what we did is, you know, I'll back up for a second. If the dishwasher didn't exist and you needed to build a robot to clean your dishes, what do you think people would do? Because right question. Now, the industry is
washing their hands.
Exactly. The industry right now, if you look at how automated food robots is if the dishwasher didn't exist, they're saying, I need to build robotic arms that attach to a sink and duplicate human actions to wash my dishes.
Which is
that's wrong. What people, right. And it's incredibly complex. You're using cameras and AI and automation to build things that are like $10,000 to hand wash dishes. Instead of someone coming along and saying, I built this box. Yes, it's not standard. Yes, it's nothing. But if you put everything in it, it will wash your dishes as good as you're using your hands. But you have to put like the pods in it, or the gel, and you create all the secondary industry. And you know, investors hear that and they're like, I can't do that. Robotic arms are simple. I understand that.
But they're not. So I'm like, keep the knee, please. Sorry. Yeah.
So that is how we treated this coming in. So my team, me, none of us come from the food industry. And when we had our aha moment, we said, why is it that I can't have a single box that is both the refrigerator / freezer and the cooking appliance in one thing, right?
Yeah.
And it sounds counterintuitive because you're putting something that is, if it's a freezer, it's -20°C, -4°F, next to something that goes up to, in a self-cleaning mode, 800°F, and it's in one box. And you think, oh, that doesn't work. It doesn't. But let's talk space systems for a second. how many times do you have to devise something that literally it sees the sun and then doesn't see the sun? And just like that, it goes from, you know, 300 to negative 300 or something like that.
Yeah.
It's that's the kind of thing where I'm like, that's not a hard problem to solve. So this is where the technology starts coming in and the analogies. So we built a device that that has a freezer on board and has an oven on board. And the oven can do convection, conduction, air frying, broiling, browning, bottom heating, top heating. And I can get into that technology later, but we have a device. And this is where the Keurig analogy starts coming in. We built a hardware appliance that is the cornerstone of an ecosystem. It is a new thing. And we're using all existing technology to make it happen. But in order to have it happen, you have to have a cartridge for how it works. And so we designed a standardized cartridge that will work with our device. But we're not food people. So like Keurig, we're going out there and we're partnering with food companies. And we're showing them that there's a lot of value add by our convenience. It's the same thing with Keurig. Why would Starbucks, that has stores on every corner, want to put coffee into a pod system so people don't leave their home? Well, it's because it's accessing a completely different market. And so we have the same thing with the food partners that we're talking to. We're talking to restaurants. We're talking to individual chefs. We're talking to ghost kitchens, local, national, regional. And they all see a different value add. One of the nice things is data. When someone cooks a meal in an automated system, we're collecting passive data on how a person is cooking, when they're cooking. Right now, food companies, they sell a ton to a store and they might hear back how many that store sold off based on how they have to restock it. But if they want to know who's eating it, they have to pay a company like Nielsen millions of dollars to do focus groups and surveys and things like that. Well, we're just collecting it and we can provide it back to them completely passively. So that's the Keurig aspect of it with the pods. Now, where the Epson ink cartridge model comes in is because the device scans those pods, it has to make sure it's a valid pod. And the reason for that is we're an early company. And if you put a meal in your oven and you burn it, who do you blame? Do you go, oh, my oven is terrible? Or do you go, I'm a bad cook? You go, I'm a bad cook. Because you believe the oven isn't at fault. But when it's a startup appliance that's cooking for itself, even if you made the meal and it burns it, well, it's the startup's fault. Then they won't buy my product or they'll give it a bad review. So we have to curate the experience, which means the chefs who make those meals program how it cooks in the metadata of that meal. So that means that when you load a meal, it has to be one of our meals because we want to make sure you're getting the perfect experience. And that means that if someone puts a random meal in there from some knockoff party, it's going to say invalid meal. This is not a good meal. So that's the Epson model on that. Now going back to how
In a way, it's also kind of the Keurig model, right? Because like the people at this point have that companies make the pods where you can throw your own beans in there, but they never taste as good. Or Nespresso is a better example because Nespresso is like in my mind, a higher end product. It's a more controlled end to end experience, and you know you can get the custom fill your own Nespresso pod, but it's never going to taste the same. You know?
So that's where Keurig and Epson come into this play. So now let's go into the Roomba analogy. So you brought up how long does it take to cook, things like that. Well, if you had a Roomba, would I ask you how long does it take to vacuum your house?
No,
because you're at work, you're at the store, it just vacuums your house. It could take 5 hours for a room that you could vacuum in 15 minutes, but guess what? You didn't have to do anything. So ours is the same thing. If you open the app and you see – so our device, it stores 5 meals in the freezer. So at any point in time, you have 5 available options. And they can be breakfast, lunch, dinner, desserts, snacks, anything you can cook in an oven basically.
Cool.
And you would look at the meal and you say, ooh, I want the lasagna for dinner tonight. So hit lasagna, schedule, have ready at 6 p.m. It could start it at 2 in the afternoon. Does it matter to you? No. It could take 4 hours. It could take 2 hours. It could take 20 minutes.
Cool.
For you, it's ready at 6 p.m. And we are going to build in AI and advanced concepts where if you get stuck at the office late or you want to make a grocery store stop, it accounts for your extra travel time. So you think you're going to be home 40 minutes later, it's ready at 6:40 instead of 6 o'clock so that you don't have to worry about a meal getting cold.
And it sounds like an end user could say, you know, I want this to be ready at time X and the system will figure out to make sure it's ready by then and not, you know, overcooked, undercooked. Been sitting too long.
Exactly.
You know.
So it's not only just time X, but we say just when I get home, purely geolocation based.
That's cool.
Yep. So we'll have all that feature. And going into the overcooked, undercooked, because the fully curated experience, you have a chef who made the meal, and you know chefs. When a chef makes a meal that has their name on it, they want it to taste really good. And yeah. So they're not going to release something. And so this is where we kind of become like an app store for appetizers, right? I'm an engineer. I make terrible jokes. But it's,
I'm used to it. It's okay.
Yeah. But by putting our standardized oven and our standardized tray in the same kitchen that these chefs make these meals, they can perfect the meal. And then all they do is upload that cook directions to our database. Done. Now, every time someone makes that meal, it comes out perfect as if that chef was in your kitchen making it. But we'll take it a step farther. So this is where the Netflix example comes in. I make a meal. I rate that meal. So now I can get matched with similar meals that follow the style I like, or say, here's a new meal that just came out that matches your history of what you like if you do that. But that direct feedback of clicking a basic star gets right back to the chef. And then we can push a simple survey of saying too much pepper, or it was a little more burned. And they can easily just tweak their recipe and update the database for the cooking method in real time, and now that meals will be different to take into that user account without having to reprint boxes or anything like that. For all those concerns.
And I'm guessing that you have some kind of it'll be meals delivered on a scheduled basis based on the feedback it's getting from each user, and you're shipping these things frozen, I assume.
You got it. So we are doing frozen food.
Yeah, sorry.
So we standardize how it ships. You always get 15 meals in a box. So all the boxes are the same size, all the amount of dry ice, the cost. And so when you order meals, it's going to be about $180 on average for the 15 meals, which comes out to about $12 a meal. Yeah, it's about 12 ounces on average per meal. So it's 3/4 of a pound of food.
Very fair.
Not terrible. It's still cheaper than a Big Mac meal. Those are $14 now.
Or a Chipotle burrito.
And these are meals that are handcrafted by chefs that tell how it cooks. So it's essentially like getting takeout from a restaurant at half the price. That's cooked as if that chef was in your house cooking it for you with zero time commitment to yourself. So this circles all the way back to what you asked in the beginning, which is, if you were on a plane talking to me, what are we solving for? So there is a threefold problem around food. And if you treat it like a three-way Venn diagram, there's nothing in the center. There's no solution that handles all three where they overlap. So the three points of this Venn diagram are time, money, and quality. And that can be quality, either nutritional quality or end product quality. End product quality means I put something in the microwave, it's going to be soggy. I would never put a pizza in the microwave or a steak in the microwave. You're not getting a good,
please don't.
But it's cheap and it saves time. Yep. Now, if you go to the other side, it's cooking, good quality, low cost savings, but 17-day year time commitment, and if you include grocery shopping. And then, of course, there's the saving time and saving and getting good quality, which means getting takeout, which is over 325% more expensive. Or if you add Uber Eats and DoorDash, it jumps up to over 750% more expensive. And 8 in 10 drivers have admitted to eating your food. So there's that statistic as well.
Wow.
Yeah. Everyone gets that face when you say that statistic. Yeah. It was a survey out of London of food delivery drivers. 80% of drivers have said they've eaten some of your food.
Oh, that's kind of like, I'm sorry, I'm kind of speechless, but I'm just thinking about how much delivery food I eat because I'm busy or I'm running around or I'm traveling. And it's just like, I sometimes I know. And that's why, honestly, like, so I appreciate, and I'm not the proudest of this, but like, we all have the drunk nights with our friends. We order a stupidly expensive Uber Eats McDonald's order because everyone wants McDonald's at 2 a.m. because they're drunk, right? Yeah. But like, I always appreciate how they have designed their bags and the stickers. So there literally is no way that someone could sample this, right? But then you get like takeout from like the best local places on Uber Eats that don't have these nationalized systems and teams of people thinking about this. And sometimes you're like, why is it like, in what world does like the sushi roll come with 5 pieces and not the normal 6? You're like, I feel like one of these was eaten by my driver, you know? And like, you're just trying to think about it. You're like, my food's already here. Hopefully it's not poisoned. I'm just going to eat it and pretend like nothing happened, you know? But that's a good point. So my question to you is, and not to interrupt this kind of soliloquy you started, which I want you to continue doing about the product. But so it to me, it's very apparent now what problems it's solving. So I guess my question is, so how many Do you call them pods or capsules? Like, what is the your term you use for the meals?
I don't have a good name yet. I've been toying around with the name of CDs, selfie dishes. But you know, then I can say it's a, a five CD changer in there. I don't know.
You know, give it a throwback. That was my next question. So it can have five meals, and so can it move a meal from the freezer side to the heating side? So you can, like, if you have five loaded on your phone, it can just send one in, or you have to move it manually? Like, how does that work?
Yep. So going back to the room analogy, the whole point of this is we are the first kitchen appliance that completely removes the human from every step of the equation. So the reason you put a freezer and an oven in one device is so that the device can take the meal out of the freezer for you, put in the oven for you, all while you're away. So we are focused on single people cooking one meal at a time. That's why it's 12 Makes ounces sense. Of food in a tray. And again, you can phrase this. Every person I've talked to has a different use case for what they want, right? We think a typical 22 to 45-year-old single person or in a really early relationship type thing, you know, they're working crazy hours, multiple jobs. But you know, you could put five dinners in there and then throughout the week, like you can do that, pick your dinners, or you could be a heavy user, put your breakfast, your lunch, your dinner, your afternoon snack and your dessert in there. You just burn through an entire, a loadout in one day as you're going. But you do it all from your phone. So there's nothing. So macronutrients, calories, all of that's in there. So you can track it to like a Fitbit. I mean, look at Fitbit, right? The clunkiest part of Fitbit is the meal tracking. And now this automates that side of
it. It's awful. It's awful.
And so you have that, you have expiration dates. So you'll get notifications if your meal's going to expire. But I'm going to go into why we did frozen, because part of that is the expiration dates. Then also, let's take it even further, food safety. When there's a recall, you'll get there's no way to know if there's milk. You'll see on the news, anyone who has lettuce from California needs to throw it out. How do I know if I have lettuce from California? But we track every ingredient in our tray. So you'll get a notification on your phone saying that tray has a recall on it. It is bricked. We will not let you cook it. Throw it out. We'll replace it for you. Right? Food safety without extra food waste, because we're tracking every ingredient into every tray with using data to analyze it. So I do want to go back onto the frozen food. So we use frozen food for a number of reasons. In the U.S., people have this mentality frozen is bad. When you say a frozen meal, somebody, for some reason, you think 50-year-old 1970s TV dinner.
Well, it's because of all the preservatives that people got used and accustomed to doing. And if you can do frozen without them, frozen food's fine. It's actually preferred, especially if it's fresh.
What's interesting is almost all frozen food nowadays does not use those preservatives. They haven't in almost 20 years or so.
Interesting.
But people still when I used to hear frozen food, I would think that one scene in Matilda where she takes the carrot and flies it around while they're sitting watching the game show. No problem. But frozen food has so many benefits. Okay. One, it produces 42 less carbon impact to the environment than fresh food. And that's because of the long duration infrastructure associated with it. Fresh food has to be flown to its destination so it doesn't go bad. And flying in general produces,
that makes sense.
Versus a frozen car on a train or a frozen truck. Mm-hmm. So you get 42 less just on the shipping it from the farm to its location.
42% or
42X. 42X.
Oh, 42X. Oh my God.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
It's 420% more carbon emission from fresh food than frozen. So frozen food has that right off the bat. Second of all, it leads to 8 times less food waste. So fresh food typically expires within 2 weeks. Frozen food has a 6 to 12 month lifespan. Yeah. And so with fresh food, what happens, and again, I'm bouncing around all over the place. What happens with fresh food is that people that are getting meal delivery of fresh food is they're focused so heavily on eating those meals within the 2 weeks so they don't expire, because they paid anywhere from $10 to $20 for that meal, they get burned out by the time their subscription ends, and then they have to jump to another meal company. And that's because fresh food also has a much lower margin, because you are making it same day, you're shipping it same day, you have to keep it fresh, you're getting a lot of wasted food if it gets lost in the mail. And so their margins are low, so they don't have as money to focus on SKUs. Now, we are a Keurig model, so we don't have to care about SKUs. We just partner on a new company, and boom, we just now have 50 more SKUs. So there's that. So going back to the frozen food, the final thing is that fresh food loses 50% of its nutritional value in the first 24 hours. Frozen food loses that same amount over 7 months. So wow. Not only are you getting a meal that lasts longer, but you're having a meal that actually is better for you nutritionally.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this is my one thing in here is that I've long stood by, I buy most of my vegetables and fruits frozen, mostly for convenience. But after doing the same research as you, I kind of realized that if I'm buying from the right people and they're flash freezing it, right? Freezing it as soon as it's basically right as picked as possible. And it's, cause you can basically have whatever you want. If you want, all the GMOs in the world, or you want organic grown by someone named Sally, you can get them all frozen. You just find them. Right. And so, that's the thing is that convenience of saying I have peas and I could make them tomorrow or next month or March. And it's still gonna be better than me buying the fresh peas from the farmer's market. Right.
Yeah. Lets you have a better farm to table because a majority of our farms are in the middle of the country. And so a meal being made in the middle of the country and flash frozen can easily transport over a month to the end destination without any impact to your nutritional quality or the environment. That's awesome. So we get better meals, more farm to table opportunities by using frozen food. And that's, probably one of our biggest hurdles is the education that you have to provide with that on frozen food. But that's kind of what we're doing. And with frozen, people always worry frozen doesn't turn out well. Well, again, going all the way back to what we talked about with the chefs who make these meals, they are practicing with them as frozen in their oven kitchens. And when I've talked to these chefs, they start getting into details of the flash freezing process has to do with you have to let the meal after it cooks, if it's a pre-cooked meal, come to room temperature so that when you freeze it, it's about the size of the microcrystals that come up from the freezing process. And the smaller the crystal, the smaller the crystal from the freezing process, the better preserved your meal is and the better it will taste in the end. So what you want is a very fast freezing process on almost a room temperature meal that then when you defrost it, and the key is defrosting it. And so the first thing our product does is defrosts it. And that's where have a problem is people don't want the time commitment associated with defrosting a meal.
Defrosting. Spending 15 minutes. It's a different amount of temperature and a different amount of humidity and a different amount of time, right? So
yes.
So just to go back one quick question, because I'm sure someone has the same question as me, the crystal size we're talking about, that's purely based on, I'm guessing, the water content of the food, and the longer it takes to freeze, the larger it has a chance to draw water from elsewhere and expand, right? That's all it's about.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay,
it can cause dried out sections and freezer burn sections. So one nice thing, and I mentioned it earlier, is added preservatives. So the flash freezing process, because of how quickly it does it, what actually happens is it takes the natural sugars and the natural proteins of the ingredients of the food and uses that as the preservative in the flash freezing process. So we don't actually have to add all these extra processes like they did 50 years ago because of the flash freezing, which is not how they did it 50 years ago. Yeah. And we're not even doing that part of it. That's just the science I'm learning from these chefs. So.
Yeah, no, it's a fun. So let's talk, kind of the next big echelon of this product, which is cost. So, I know that you guys are still in the R&D phase, let's say. When do you plan on getting this to a point where people can start trying it? And also, what is your tactic to trying it? Because I feel like something like this, you have a very high bar and you want people to try it, but they might not want to commit to the cost of buying a machine, right? So what are you guys thinking about in terms of getting over that?
So one of the key things that we have done is we want to make this as appealing to consumers as possible. So with every effort of the R&D that we did, we focused on getting the smallest footprint possible. And so this thing is, it's smaller. If you did a bird's eye view, it's smaller than a microwave from bird's eye view, because we use vertical space. So it nicely fits directly under your above counter countertop cabinets. It's that same height and it's the same depth as those countertops. So you still get countertop space in front of it. You still have space on the sides of it. And so we wanted to make sure we didn't eat up too much countertop space. But why do you put a kitchen appliance in the kitchen? Because you have to access the fridge.
That's a good question. I never thought about that.
Because our product is completely self-contained, you don't even have to put this in a kitchen. You can put it in an office. You can put it in a den. You can put it in a bedroom. You can put it in a studio apartment, right? you don't actually have to sacrifice kitchen space for our kitchen appliance. If as long as you have silverware with it, you can put it wherever you want. And a napkin, yeah. I guess. So we put that in mind for the consumer as well. So we've been at this for 6 years. In that 6 years, we have built proof of concept Frankenstein things where we literally hacked apart a toaster oven and a mini fridge and put them together and programmed it to work until we did Alpha units. And so now we're on our 10th iteration of our product. It is our pre-production version. It's using production techniques. It has all the parts and the BOM cut down. So it's as close to production. And what we've done is we launched a beta pre-sale. So we actually have about 100 users who put down $150 just to be a beta tester. And that's cool. That sold out within a month through just organic traction. And these people are waiting for their beta units. That beta unit will come to them for 3 months. They'll order the meals delivered to their door. They'll use it for 3 months through the app and everything of that nature. And that's kind of where we are. We're getting ready for that beta experience. We're actually raising capital right now to fund that beta experience just to build the inventory for it. Because the product's at a point where that is ready. And once that beta experience is done, we'll take the feedback to make any final tweaks to the hardware and, of course, to the app. And then we'll get ready for formal pre-sales. So going to your question of how much is this going to cost, we're believing a price between $550 and $750 is going to be the end retail price.
Yeah, it's a good sweet spot.
So it's not crazy expensive, but you do think twice. But for those who are concerned about cost, we also are offering an option where you would pay only $50 for the unit if you sign up for a 6-month subscription of food.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And that opens
and
the door
to 6 months minimum. I'm guessing minimum of 15 meals a month, or are you doing 1 meal a day?
Yeah,
or
what's the minimum there? A monthly order is 15 meals. So it's about $180 in meals.
Yeah.
You can order more. If you want, technically, I think the way we're going to structure it is not even 6 months. It's just 6 orders of food within 6 months. So you could order all 6 in the first month.
Yeah, because maybe someone just once says like, oh, I want those 3 times a day. And that's for a month, and that's 6 orders right there, right?
Yes. And so we do have the software baked in where based on how quickly you're using meals, we say reorder now in order to have your next set of meals arriving in time. We'll have that baked in. We have the expiration date baked in, which will take a long time to reach. But once your subscription's done, you can keep a subscription. I think what we'll offer is subscription model. We'll have a discount on it over just the ad hoc kind of the subscribe and save like Amazon model. You can buy something where you can get like a 5 to 10% savings by being on the
And then are there going to be different tiers of meals? Like, it'd be like, I'm sure there's like, it sounds like the quality is already high. So there's not going to be like low quality. What I'm saying is like, maybe you work with like a well-known chef that has well-known restaurants and they have like a higher end meal that comes with maybe higher end ingredients or style.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? Like, is
that
what you're thinking?
The nice thing is, it's just like we feel like the website we're creating will eventually be the app store for food, for our unit, for our ecosystem. And again, this is just not something because this doesn't exist, right? You essentially you have an oven and you go to the grocery store to buy all the different brands. We're going to have the same thing. And the brands will dictate their price. They'll dictate their ingredients, their quality, their portion sizes. The only thing that's going to be unique or the standard about all of them is they will all have the standard tray and the same lid. But just like Keurig, the lid will be designed by them for whatever their branding they want. Now, what we're going to do to launch is we're going to have this hybrid model where you will order sets of 5. Those set of 5 are predetermined, but you'll have a whole slew of different sets of 5. So it'll be like the breakfast or the dinner 5, and you'll pick 3 of them to go into a box. But that lets you then go cross brand, right? You don't have to buy all 15 from the same brand. You could get the dessert from, Betty Crocker dessert ones and the breakfast from Jimmy Dean or something like that and all that.
And so all your licensing will come from a perspective of the contents, but it doesn't sound like you're ever going to also license out the technology and, I guess proprietary barcode system plus tray to an end user. So like Costco couldn't say, hey, we want to make a deal with you. We're going to offer some of our meals as an option, but we're going to manufacture them in your system.
No, we're going
to
do that. So we will have multiple different partnership setups. One where we control everything, where we set the price, we're licensing a brand and we do everything. We use their recipes, their things like that. We'll have the other side, which is someone makes the brand, we sell them our tray, they do everything, they provide mm-hmm. the data back to us, and every time someone makes one of their meals, we collect a royalty off of that. And so it's because of the barcode system, we collect that passively on the back end. And eventually, once we hit a critical mass of users and trust in our system, we'll open it up to almost be like an Etsy store type thing. Anyone can make a recipe, start selling meals in our tray, upload through a standard API to our site the cook ingredients, because as it goes back to, if you burn something in your oven, do you blame us or do you blame yourself? We need to build the trust with our users where they know our unit's good, and that if a meal turns out poorly, it's because the person who made the meal entered in instructions wrong or something like that. And so we need to build the confidence that our technology is good before we start opening the door to let anyone create meals or even cook themselves and load it in.
Cool. That's awesome. So what are the thoughts? What are the things that keep you up at night? Like what are your biggest issues right now facing Celsi?
The chicken and egg that comes with being a hardware startup. Unfortunately, being a hardware startup, you don't fit into being able to just put something out there and have users because you need money to build it. But no venture capital wants to give you money to do it until you have users. And that's been our biggest holdup. It's why we're 6 years into this, right? We've raised a good amount of capital over the last 6 years. I mean, nowhere close to a million at all, but not even close to that. I'm talking that just a couple hundred thousand that have let us
enough
build.
Enough to build what you built, which is everything. You know, so.
But it's like but at the same time, constantly raising money is just a distractor to a degree. Because I have to worry every time I build a unit, I'm depleting our bank account. So then I immediately have to start fundraising to do it again. And especially because we're fully patented, we're having contingency patents. And then you're like, okay, I'm in a good place. And then a lawyer bill comes in. You're like, okay, I have negative money in my account. Let's go raise again.
I know this feeling well. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just this constant, like, scrappy thing that is difficult. So we're, as I said, we're 10 iterations into our product now, and we're ready to do a beta. So we're like finally going out there and raising what I would consider real capital. Like we're trying to raise our first $1 million round so that we can get the product. And so that's what keeps me up in mind. Like I just, the numbers on our bank account, that's how am I going to pay our next bill when it comes in? Am I going to get that next check in the door to cover it?
Well, I'll make this an offline conversation, but you and I can talk after, because I think I can help. But with Celsi, like what do you see this eventually as something? Because I think one question keeps coming back to my mind is that you mentioned that, you know, what your day job is now is like already your dream job, right? And then you are kind of, you have the reins of what could be a huge technology company, right? So at some point in time, there is a choice you're going to have to make. I think the question I'm about to ask is coming, which is that like there probably is a future in which you have to give up your day job to focus on Celsi for a bit.
Oh yeah, that's this round. Well, if we raise this round, I'm quitting my job. It's a tough thing to say. And the reason I'm
your dream job, right?
Yeah, I worked hard to get to where I am, right? Yeah, you know,
sure.
I'm literally dealing with like $10 million or $100 million contracts for shooting things into space. Like you know, it takes a lot of work to get there. But again, it goes back to that intangible thing of you create something. It's just you follow it. It's just so it's just so cool to see where it goes. And so, yeah, I'm ready to make that leap. I mean, as you probably have heard throughout this recording, banging on the door next to me, I have three kids, right? So I have to pay the bills. I have to have health insurance. So, you know, I'm almost 35, right? I'm not a young 20 startup who can live with five people in a one bedroom apartment, scrapping by, doing a startup, failing, doing another startup. Like, coming into this, I'm being very meticulous with how I'm approaching this, right? It's, you know, if I'm making this jump, I'm making sure that I have the controls in place, that I can continue to support my family, and all of those things. And, you know, there's always this stuff like with startups, like, you know, I feel like all the things that people talk to about startups is really focused to that college student, early 20-year-old startup founder of this like scrappy, you're putting it all in, you're committing. But, you know, there's all this research also that like people, the founders in their 30s or in 40s are sometimes the more successful founders because they're putting in a completely different mental approach to how they do it. And I think that's kind of where we are.
Apologies, everyone. We had a little bit of a technical kind of audio thing there, but back to what I was saying, which I believe was that I truly believe most founders nowadays are it's more the Jeff Bezos and less the Steve Jobs or Elon Musk. And what I say about that is like Bezos, who had a full career, had a family started, you know, and didn't like start at a young age and risk everything on it. Right. I mean, he still risked a lot for sure, but like that, I've learned almost all the people I work with have either families or they're not in their lower 20s because there is a sense of stability from not only a mental but also professional perspective that they kind of realize like, you know, if I go out and do this, I am also risking my family or something else. And that makes it like the stakes are significantly higher. And I think because of that, they're usually more successful, you know?
Though I wish I could get a $200,000 loan from my parents to start my company.
No, for sure. Like, I mean, that me too, right? But I'll also like the way that capital works right now, it's like I know so many people that started companies that way. Like mommy and daddy gave them $1 million to fund what they want. Rarely, if ever, do those things ever work out. Like never, ever work out, right? And I think it's mostly – it's not because they didn't have – the, you know, what some would call like the chutzpah, like the balls, the know-it-all, the tact to do it. It's just that like when you have to earn it, when you have to put yourself in that hole and dig yourself out, like you're never the same person again, right? Like what you're able to do afterwards is like it's expounding. You get exactly what I'm talking about, right? So like
Well, there's a awesome thing in that I found, and I've tried to explain this to people that aren't in the startup community, because they all feel like, oh, well, you feel like you owe it to these investors. You can't give up. You have to give it, like they give you your money. And it's more than that, because for where we are, right, we have no revenue.
You don't
revenue.
Owe anyone shit, man.
Technically, like, so. No, but what is the people who invested in us so far, actually, they invested in me, right? They didn't invest necessarily in Celsius. Yes, they believe in the concept, but what they really believed in is that I can make it a reality. Because when I went to my first friends and family round, right, I was able to get like a couple, like 5,000 from a couple people, 5,000 each from a couple people 6 years ago. And I literally had a sketch. That's it. I mean, yeah, there was a business plan, but they weren't going to read a 45-page business plan.
But they're believing in you, right? Like they believe
like
in
they
you.
Believe, they're like, they think this concept's cool, but yes, Max can make it happen. And so that's what part of drives me, right? It's like, yeah, they're not going to put in money they couldn't lose, right? It's you know, I mean, for some of them, but
maybe I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know what it's about.
Each person's but at the same time, it's I don't want them to give up on me, right? Because they trust me, they believe in me, that they're putting that their faith in my hands, and it's really that confidence, that support that keeps me going. Even 6 years later.
So what have you, I kind of just we can get a few kind of more solid capsulated takeaways for, because there's a good amount of people that listen to this that either are people that have been in the show that are also similar. Like I have a friend named Oli who's on the show who has a startup called Switchback. And what they do is he basically uses the highest quality, fresh picked, dehydrated fruit and makes smoothie packets that allows for kids and adults to get the highest amount of nutrients from real fruits and vegetables in like a drink form. And it was founded based on the fact that he was trying to figure out a good way to give his kids nutrients, right? And he has three young kids like you. He's out in Minnesota. But I think you and him would hit it off because you're around the same age. You're in around the same point. And he just actually like left his job a few months ago to like go full in on this. You know, he's like, it's utterly terrifying and utterly exciting, you know? Yeah. So, you know, but like, so to kind of encapsulate, like what are some things that you now know that seem so second nature that you just wasn't obvious to you when you were first making that decision? Like what are if you could go back and like, you know, go back to 6 years ago max and say, hey, these things will seem really simple, but they're not. And like, how would you handle it differently so that you could save yourself time and money and stress, you know?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of things. Never pay someone to provide assistance for fundraising or something like that, whether they're a finder or even a Series 7 broker dealer. Never pay someone for that because they're getting their pay. And like, there's no incentive for them. You're just losing money. Secondly, don't trust contractors to actually deliver on time or what you even asked for. And that's, I feel like I should have known that coming from government contracting, but I think when you're doing government contracting, there are so many like red tape requirements and it's such large amounts of money. It's different. And it's, and part of it is it's not your money, right? It's a contract dollar. It's not your company. But like when you're going to a subcontractor and it's like, here's $10,000. I need to do this thermal analysis CAD whatever thing, because we just don't have the software to do it, and you guys have like five engineers that you can spread that across and get it done.
Yeah, totally.
And you get it back and you're like, okay, that looks great, but you don't dig into the data. And then after a while, like, you finally get the next round of funding that you needed after all this time to do like the next thing, but you don't want to use them because you had so much difficulty getting data from them. You say, here's what they gave me, and someone opens and they're like, this is a shell file, there's nothing in here. And so it's like, and then you go back to them like, where is this? They're like, well, you didn't do the sub part of your contract that says that after 6 months, we're going to delete all your data. You didn't pay to have us retain your data for 7 years. And so Jesus. Right. So it's like, you just expect,
go fuck yourself. Right.
Right. Like, you expect level of human decency in these exchanges, especially in a startup. But what you find is all the people are like, oh yeah, we know we work with a lot of startups and we do this. It's like, what I learned is like when they say that, they're like, we take advantage of a lot of startups. Like that's really what they're saying. And that would be my recommendation to anyone is you need to stay on top of everyone for doing stuff. Honestly, if you can do it in-house, do it. Just don't trust a contractor to do anything right.
And I want to expand on that because, you know, the company I run, so, you know, I'm a member of a few startups. I founded a few companies myself. This podcast that also has a magazine component of it, which we can talk about another time. One of the things I founded that was like really different, but I started a studio at the same time to fix this problem because there were so many people I knew that were just getting, excuse my French, fucked over by so many different people and so many different things that I built a studio called Afocal off of two premises, right? It's just that we're going to do the best possible work at the best possible price, which is normally an anomaly, right? Like there's no standard fee structure. There's no, like, you have to pay this money to keep your data and do something like that. No, it's just like, if we say we're going to do something, we're going to do it and it's fully featured, right? And then part two is that we never want to build a system or a contract where we're relying on recurring revenue. So like, I can't tell them the amount of things where like, oh, we're going to build a website for you, but you have to pay us $1,500 a month to maintain the website. It's like, okay, why can't you just make it and have it work, right? And if something really is broken, then you fix it, right? And so I built this off of these premises of like the issues I was having, the issues that you're having. And I always love having this conversation because like, I understand that you have zero reason to trust me, right? So I always work with people and say, let us do the most maximum amount of work we can for the most minimal amount of money to prove to you what we can do and then start helping you take over other things. And that's been our success so far. And that's why I've been able to scale up and, you know, have dozens of clients and have fun because like there are so many people out there that are just not delivering. And when people are like, oh, well, send me some, you know, information on potential competitors so I can compare. And I'm like, you can do whatever research you want. That's not my job to give you, you know, competitor research. But at the end of the day, like, I'm promising you that I deliver or you don't pay me. And at the end of the day, like, that's a promise that most people aren't going to ever make with you, you know? So,
And then there's a lot of, you got to trust us, or we've worked with so many people. It's like, well,
Trust me, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah. It's prove to me for no cost to myself why I should trust you. Prove it, and then I can trust you, and I'll be giving you money at that point.
Well, and also, so, you know, I get approached all the time with like broker dealers for investors and will pay us this amount of money. And look, I'd say 1 in 25 are the real deal, but that still means 24 out of 25 are wasting people's money and time. And that's not worth it. Right? Like I have a client the other day and there's this brand new capital group that is interested in connecting people. And I looked at their terms. And they all they talk about on their website, which is terribly made, is like how they're for the world and helping people and want to create wealth and opportunity and, you know, all the normal, you know, bullshit. And their terms were they get $12,000 a month and seven. You're good. You're there. You get.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Hold on. My.
It looks like your internet cut out. Yeah. Are you good? Yes, no. Now I can't hear you. Hold on. Make sure it's not me. Yeah, I still can't hear you. Uh-oh.
All right. Now sorry.
All good.
All good. All
right. You're good.
Speaker needs to be... All right, can you hear me now?
I'll cut it all out. Don't worry. My headset
died, and I had to switch headsets.
All man. All good, man. So all I was saying is that, you know, I have a client that and sorry everyone again, we had some technical issues. You're going to hear a quick little cut, and I'll cut back into this. But first it was me, then it was Max, but we're having fun. So long story short, there's this like capital group that, you know, claims they're like for the betterment of the earth and all people on it, and they wanted $12,000 a month for a minimum of a 6-month term and 7% of all equity, all money brought in. And I looked at them and I said, you guys are fucking high and out of your fucking minds. Cause like they're brand new too. And I said this, they're like, they said, okay, well, how much do you charge when you find investment for people? And I said, 0.5%. If I am closing a deal or bringing in someone they introduced to me. Because often people are like, we have investors interested, we just can't close them. And I go, okay, 0.5% is max. Like, I think that's a very fair price, right? If you're bringing in, you know, $1 million, right? Then that means you're taking home 5,000, right? That's like a very small amount if you can close the $1 million. And then the secondary thing is any amount of cash you have to pay up front, it's automatically a no-go unless they're promising that they're going to give it back to you if they don't raise the money, right? That's like that's the biggest. And this, I'm turning this into like a masterclass, people that get these offers all the time. But what I work on and I have the most interest in is it's rarely ever you need a connector. It's that there's a problem with the investment materials that you're working on, right? So the first thing that we usually do when we go into work for startups is we look at their pitch deck and their executive summary and everything else going on. And we say, how can we optimize this to actually raise money? Because sometimes as simple as like how it's laid out, or you're missing one key thing, or like it's, you're just not describing it well enough. Like, and I've learned that because we've raised $380 million for startups in the last 3 years by doing just this, where they have a pitch deck. It could be the worst thing in the world, or it could be fine, but like it's missing a lot of parts. And then we fix it and then help them raise money. And then everyone has a nice day. And almost always after that, people then go, okay, can you help us with ABC? Cause they trust us. And then we go and do the rest of it. Right. And I found that those like super low cost, almost amuse-bouche projects where it's like, it's not enough money where anyone's going to ruin anyone's day if it doesn't work out. Right. But it's enough to prove that you're there for the right reasons. Right.
Yeah. And what I have found in my experience with all the other ones, even the ones that say, you know, we only take you off the back end if you do it Then they threw Tails on
bullshit.
There. And then they go, well, they do the thing. They update your deck. They we have to do this, that, the other thing. They just don't have the right network, for us at least. And we might be a unique situation. We're a hardware product in consumer space that does not fit in the thesis of a VC, right?
Yeah.
We're playing in food, we're playing in hardware, we're playing in software. And the biggest thing we've always come across is that the thesis of a VC is so narrow to a degree that they go, I love this idea, but I can't do it. Mm-hmm. They point to another VC. And that VC says, I love this idea, I can't do it. And they point back at the same VC that just pointed you to them. And they're like, this is a good person who does it. So that has been our experience with it, is that even people that really do want to help, it's just the company that they're in or the audience that they're in, it's almost no fault of their own to a degree. It's just, at least again, in our specific case, we are an outlier. And you would think being an outlier is a great thing in venture space, right?
Yeah.
We're not a sure thing, right? We're not an app. I mean, I'm not that apps are a sure thing, but we are new. You would think that a product like ours is the definition of why venture capital exists. It is something that we know will be huge if someone gives us the trust to get us there. That initial capital to get us into market.
Yeah.
But it's almost like VCs want, the way they respond is they want a sure thing, basically. They go, well, come back to us.
And
after
nothing
you have
is
customers.
A sure thing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Like I was talking to VC the other day and I was courting them for a month and a half for this one company. And all of a sudden they like, it's always, I call it the sports stat, paradigm. And this will make total sense when I explain it. So like, they'll be like, oh, well, you only had 2.45 million in revenue last year. We needed to be 2.5 in order to qualify it. So therefore we can't. And then it's the same thing when you're watching Monday Night Football and they're like, this is the first player in NFL history to have 6 games in a row with 11 or more catches, 2 or more false starts, and 68 yards receiving and at least 46 yards rushing. And you're like, you just made this up. Like you literally just like found individual parameters that fit the realm of like, no one's done this before. Cause like, if you can do that, it's great, you know? Right. and that's why I call it the sports stat paradigm. Right. Because like so many venture capitalists use it. They're like, oh yeah. I mean, it's great. Normally it's something we'd love to invest in, but we can see here that your margins are actually quite a few points, 2.2 to be exact, off of what we seem as a nominal course for probable investment. So we're going to have to pass. It's like, can you just speak English to me? You can just say like, hey man, I don't have the balls for this. Go talk to someone else, which is what most VCs should say. You know, like I'm tired of VCs, to be honest with you. So eventually I'd love to create a place where I can like invest in products like yours with, you know, a combination of money that like evaporated, it didn't matter to the people that it came from, including myself. But more importantly, it has the potential to impact people's lives in a positive way, right? Which I think your product does. Because, I mean, look at, I think I've done a lot of research recently on stress. And as you know, how much cortisol levels can impact weight gain and continued stress and things like that. And eating is a huge part of that. Like when you're lacking sleep, when you're stressed, you reach for the most unhealthy thing. And if you're having a long day at work and you come home, you're not going to go for the healthy, nutritious meal. You're going to go for the opposite of that, right? So what this almost does is you're creating this nutritional and spatial and food hedge for the individual that allows them to ensure that even if that's the worst day at work and the worst day with their kids, they could still have something ready to go when they got home that could at least maybe hold over a small family till you could cook something or, you know, satisfy yourself, you know?
Yep. And that's, so my wife is a therapist or former therapist. She has since retired to be a full-time 24/7 mom that, God bless her. That is the hardest job known to mankind right there. I don't know how she does it. But to that, she was a therapist and she worked with specifically with women with eating disorders. And so food is a very big thing. in our family of how you talk about food, how you talk about weight, how you describe it, how you think. Like, there is no bad food, right? It's about moderation. It's about balance. And so
it always is.
Part of it is when I've talked to her is one of our use cases is working with eating disorder clinics, because one of the biggest problems she always found is that clients that were in treatment centers, they're getting all three meals taken care of themselves. And when they're finally healthy enough to leave, they'll go to a day treatment center where only lunch is handled, but dinner, snacks, desserts, breakfast aren't. And that's where you see the biggest relapse, is that transition. And so having a product like ours that a dietitian could provide the meal plan, program the meal plan, have meals ready for them, it eases that transition part for people. And that's not just eating disorders, but also, you know, any general facility where things are always handled for you. And then all of a sudden you're just pushed into the real world and you don't have that anymore. And
yeah,
we've all looked at use cases for aging in place as well, taking care of adults, parents, like your 50 and 60 year old taking care of your 70, 80, 90 year old parent. They're going to their house, they're cooking for them, they're grocery shopping for them, they're worried about them falling in the kitchen, leaving the oven on, being able to take care of their parent remotely without that burden. But with that, because of the way our system is set up, you could then pair with meals that are covered by Medicare, Medicaid, Silver Dollar, Meals on Wheels, things like that. So then there's not even an additional cost of the food. And then with that, just like the automated scooters are now covered, with enough duration, we can prove quality of life increase, and then our own device would be able to be covered by Medicare, Medicaid. And that's a free system to aging in place, especially in this environment where the aging place population is growing because they cannot afford to move to these residential facilities that start at like $13,000 a month for living there.
It's insane. And the craziest thing is I saw this great news story. It was like on one of those YouTube news channels where there's a couple in Australia and they booked 70 back-to-back 2-week cruises. Yes,
I saw that.
Because it's cheaper than it's cheaper by like over 70% than any of the cheapest like living centers. Yeah. And to be honest with you, like I'd rather be on a cruise ship because like the food's probably better. The people are probably in a way better mood. And like you're usually cruise ships for the most part are either going to cool, colder places or cool, warmer places, right? It's not like they're going to like, you know, no one takes a cruise to like through the Great Lakes to Detroit, you know, right? Like no one's taking a cruise to shitty places. Like they're going to usually interesting places either for sightseeing or for enjoyment. Right. So
I saw that exact same article.
But it's smart. And so I love this idea where like, you know, my grandma's getting older. It's the last grandparent I have left. She is still like fully capable of cooking a 7-course meal for her entire neighborhood if she wanted to. But 10 years from now, she might not be there. So being able to get this for her, she will absolutely be able and capable to load the cartridges in. And I love the idea of saying like, you know, grandma can help you set this up, but every single day at these times, it'll have food ready for you. Just make sure you refill it every couple days.
You start the meal on your phone. You give her a call and say, "Mom, your dinner's going to be ready exactly at this time." And then you get a notification saying that she took the meal out. And now you know at least she even got it. She didn't just leave it sitting in there, right? You get that added thing. And then with that, we can even then sync data for health profiles to provide to doctors and things like that, because all of the macronutrients and what their intake is tracked.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, I mean, like I love this idea and kind of every part of it because it's unlimited in what it can become and do. You know, like there's really nothing that's stopping you from, you know, making this into everything you want. I mean, it's money, right? And luckily, like money is the easiest thing and the hardest thing, as you know very well at this point, right? It's like it's all right there. You just need it. And like, yeah, I mean, it's as fun and difficult and head smashing into a wall problem to solve as is the actual engineering of the product. And that's the one thing that like I don't think people realize is like, and this is one thing I want to say to everyone out there. It's like, don't, because I talk about money and fundraising for startups a lot on this podcast. Don't be discouraged to still following your dreams. Just realize that like there are so many good ideas out there. There's so many people. There's also so many bad ideas out there that are just trying to raise money that like it's honestly a crapshoot. And if you keep working at it, you'll get it eventually. But there's no promises out there. And that's how fucked it is. So,
Our biggest problem is, besides the hardware side, is we're consumer side. And almost all VCs want B2B. But you can't have everything B2B because somebody has to sell things to consumers. And so we have a B2B version of our product. It's like a giant Amazon locker wall of meals, basically, with and use the exact same technology in our MVP. And then obviously the VCs go, well, why haven't you built that? I'm like, if I can barely afford to build this small one, how am I supposed to build this giant 10-foot long, 7-foot tall, 5-foot deep locker system? Where am I going to build it? Like my garage? Like, and then how am I going to transport it? Like, but I've proven all the individual pieces of technology that go into it. And that's something where you could put that in an airport and sync it with a flight app. And so when you're boarding starts, your meals ready.
Think
about how many airports close their restaurants in the morning or at night, or paying $12 for two pieces of bread with one slice of ham between it, and that's $12 at an airport. Or
biggest thing is delayed flights and misconnections. Yeah. It's like, so the other, I live between the East Coast and West Coast. I'm here at my girlfriend's farm in upstate New York right now. And I flew from Seattle to Syracuse, connecting in Atlanta, and like flight got inexplicably delayed for a dumb reason in Seattle. And there was a short connection window in Atlanta. So I did the sprint across the world as everyone's in Atlanta at this point. And I missed, I missed it by like 3 minutes. Luckily, they give you a hotel and those things. And I'm just like, it still sucks. But the one thing I was saying is like, after 11 PM in Atlanta, everyone's boarding flights. Like they don't have anything going out later. So everything shuts down because that's when people start putting food away and throwing things out. But I was like, there's more vending machines where I can buy Bose noise canceling headphones or like medical, everything from Pepto-Bismol to condoms to aspirin, than there is a place to get a food that's not a pack of Cheez-Its or a Snickers bar. Right. And like, I would have loved something like this where I could have said like, oh shit, like I have a Celsius at home. I know they have one in Concourse B at ATL. I know nothing's open. So I'm going to tell it right now, like that's what the meal they have available. Let's do it. And then I'll be able to pick it up, scan my phone and eat it. And I'll be much happier than, the Cheez-Its and Gatorade ended up being there.
And the thing about that is it goes beyond airports, right? It's nice. Like you put this thing in college dorms. We talked about drunk food, right? How like I went to Hopkins, right? Baltimore City. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest worries Hopkins has, and they actually have their own police force now that they got authorized, is to help because the 24-hour food is off campus. Mm-hmm. And so they have this extra work. But if students had an opportunity to have meals in their dorm room 24/7 that also they wanted, were synced
with choice.
Yeah. And were synced to their meal plan, so it wasn't even a cost to them technically. Mm-hmm. I think they would all want it because now they can go back to the dorm. They can start on their walk home from the fraternity or whatever bar and have a hot meal that was free to them and good and not off campus and not in an unsafe place. Hospitals, where when my wife was in labor and delivery with our kids, the only thing open was a 24/7 Subway. I ate five Subway sandwiches during labor, delivery, and postpartum.
Yeah,
because that was the only thing open. This would have been great to have because I could have started it and then meal would be ready, go grab it, come back into the room with the meal.
And I'm sure you get what I'm saying when I say this, but like Subway is fantastic at least the first half when you're starving on a road trip, but after the second sandwich you're like, I am really tired of this. Like this is like, I don't even know if this is real chicken. Like what is this?
It's so wild. I love the idea of Subway. Like there's times where I'm like, oh, I could go for a Subway sandwich. And then you eat and you're like, why did I really want a Subway sandwich? Mm.
Yeah. Well, I think, I have this deep and my girlfriend thinks this is hilarious. Cause like her and I will go out of our way and get reservations in our restaurants and go try the fun places around the world and like enjoy food. But also like, I love a good American deli sandwich. Like I love it so much. And especially like a good Jewish, deli in New York, like where I live for so long, like those are sandwiches that are unmatched. They're $6.75. Yep. They put whatever you want on them and they're always good. But I think that, for me, it's like, that's what Subway's trying to capture with that essence of like a proper sandwich, whether your parents or you made one, the killer one when you're growing up or the deli. There's a place in town here in upstate New York called Valentine's in Skinny Alice that makes one of the best subs I've ever had in my entire life. And it's $10.75 for a foot long. And like, that's all I want. It's good. They're using a proper, like deli ham slicer to slice the roast beef or the turkey or the chicken each time. You know, it's like, that's all you want, man. Right.
Yeah.
So I look forward to that. And obviously, like, it'd be really interesting to see what kind of innovations that you and the team come up with this. Cause obviously, like, you're talking about a homogenous mixture of food that is being heated at the same temperature and consistency throughout, but I'm sure eventually you're gonna start playing with, like, you know, maybe two separate chambers of a certain, you know, CD that can heat at different temperatures and consistencies and then be combined easily, like if it's a sauce and a pasta, or even like, I think of those really awful 1990s kids microwave meals where it came with like a couple chicken nuggets, the like brownie in the plastic tray. There was like some hot applesauce and then like some kind of vegetable. And they were awful. They were awful. I still remember the taste of that brownie. It's like an easy bake oven is miles better than this thing.
And we're already thinking about those things in our future iterations for like family size versions. But I mean, our oven is already dynamic, right? We have two heating elements, a fan, a shutter system, a hot plate. And then when you just change those variables, you get different styles of cooking. And so,
what I think, and I'm sure you thought about this, like, to me, I have obviously proper size homes, but like, I love the idea of having micro homes all over the world and like a couple places I enjoy and like, and it would be awesome to have one of these just ready to go. Cause I don't want to have a full kitchen, but I still want the ability to have it make hot food, but I don't want to deal with the mess of the cleanup or having the, like all those appliances to make these things. Yep. So like, you know, having a small little cabin in the woods and having this plugged in and just saying like, oh, I'll be there in 2 hours, like time to start the meal. And when I get there, it's like ready to go. So that to me is like, I want that. You know, to be honest, it'd be like,
glamping is a good example of where this would work.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But cool, man. So I'll get you out of here. And obviously I think we need a part two to dive into I want to go deep on some of the NASA stuff eventually, but you know, I think that from a perspective of most of the people, you know, listening to this podcast, like there's a deep interest in consumer technology. There's deep interest in understanding how people tick in the systems. And I think that people learned a lot about you based on, you know, how you went about answering these questions about these different things. So I appreciate that. So these rapid fire questions are designed in a way that to kind of make you really think, and you know, you can answer in one word or many words, but they're meant to be just a way for kind of the audience to kind of re-encapsulate, you know, who you are as a person. So if you had to give a TED talk and you couldn't talk about, you know, your current or main focuses, like it wouldn't be NASA aerospace related and it couldn't be Celsi food, that whole thing related, what would it be on? You know, like what else are you spending your free time in your weekends? Or like, what is a weird obsession that you have that maybe no one knows about? Like, what would a TED talk be like?
Okay. My TED talk would be on the mental concept of DIY. Right. I'll guess I go to this. I built my own deck. I've never built a deck before. And when I say I built a deck, it's like a 900 square foot deck with a built-in shed underneath it, electric outlets, all this stuff. And my wife was saying forever, you're not doing this. You're not doing this. Like, you don't have the skills to do this. Like, I'm terrified. I dug the holes. I poured the concrete. I lifted up the 6x6 beams, all this stuff. It took me 2 years. But my TED talk would be on this thing of like, DIY should not be scary. And that when someone says, I can do this, they can do this. And that there is enough support out there that you need to give people the credit. Like, you know, when someone's like, oh, I bought a house and, you know, it was a DIY type previous owner. And you think, oh, God, no, it just means you get custom things that you want in a way that no one else could do.
I think that there are a lot of really good YouTubers that kind of help with this whole idea of DIY. Like, you can get hyper specific and there are so many construction woodworking channels out there that make it awesome people, but like, even from the get-go, like, I think the mentality that people like a Jerry Rig Everything or a Casey Neistat, this idea of like, what I bought isn't exactly what I needed for, but so I'm going to amend it until it works for me, right? Which goes back to that idea of like, I view myself, I think you are too, an unreasonable man, right? A reasonable man adapts himself to the world, and the unreasonable one persists in adapting the world to themselves. Therefore, all progress depends on the reasonable man, right? So like, I think at the basis of DIY is all advancement in society, right? Because like, when you think about even something as complex as the space shuttle, right? Like NASA as an entity was really DIYing that. Like no one had done that before. No one had done a reusable spacecraft that was meant to take people and objects into space or back from space, right? Like that's crazy, right? And I understand that your kind of focus is more on like the individual, the home, the family, but I think it applies at all levels, right? Like in the end of the day, like what you build as a startup, like that is also a DIY. And I think that that's such an important mentality to hold. Like it's almost like goes back to my sister. They wrote their thesis for undergrad on the importance of play. They studied anthropology and sociology and like, you know, as someone who also grew up and still plays with a lot of Legos, like I think that play is always so important to me. Like the ability to just try something without a certain need for it to exist. And I think that's one of those beautiful ideas and stress relief comes from it. Look at that. Yeah. Yeah. I was just trying to explain to my girlfriend why I also need to make room for the UCS Venator after having, you know, the UCS Star Destroyer and the UCS Millennium Falcon and the UCS Republic Gunship and the UCS like, So you and I are going to be friends. I think we're going
to
be
friends. Yeah, no, my wife put in her vows, she goes, we may not agree that Lego is a home decor item.
I have convinced my girlfriend only for certain sets. I recently, we're not near a Lego store because we're in rural New York. There's one 30 minutes that way and an hour that way. And I went to pick up our iPhones, pick them up in the Apple store when they came out. And I stopped at the Lego store and the Lego Concord just came out. And so I bought that. And that is like one of those display pieces that's beautiful. And like, I think everyone can get an appreciation for that. I have the full NASA set in my kitchen, in my apartment, like on this like shelf above the kitchen that was just built in naturally. And I have like, you know, the space shuttle and the Saturn V and the lunar lander, and people appreciate those. You know, people might not get the Star Wars ones always, but like the NASA spacecraft, the airplanes, I think people can always find some kind of value in that. And it's fun. You know, like, I don't know if you plan on getting the Concorde or have the Concorde, but like from a builder's perspective, it was one of the funnest builds I've had in the past few years.
I have the space shuttle over there. I've had it for 3 years. I have not had a chance to open it.
I understand. It's still in the box. The space shuttle also lived in my closet for years. The Saturn V was one of my favorite ones that I built.
That is on my desk at my office.
Yeah.
It was
on my desk at work too.
Yeah.
People are like, that's awesome. Is that Lego? Did you build that yourself? I was like, well, I used their instructions and bought their set, but I did build it. Yes. Is that what you're asking? So I actually had a boss that at one point, I was an intern. This was back in 2017. I brought it in. My first thing I put on the desk is big Saturn V. And he's like, that's so cool. And I was like, he's like, if I buy one and I pay you to build it for me, will you build it? And I said, you're asking one of the easiest questions in the world. Will I be paid? Will I get paid to build Legos? Of course I will get paid to build Legos. And I was like, why do you want to build it? He's like, well, I want to be able to say that a rocket science built this rocket. And I was like, okay, understood. All right.
Yep.
Like, ha ha. Good. Funny. You know, whatever, man. But yeah, it was fun. I was like, I absolutely built them for that. And it was the most amount of fun. Okay, I can ask this question to you. I've only asked this question two other times because now I know I can ask this. If you could have, you know, one Lego set from all of Lego that was released, officially released, so none of like the special sets that you could get for like the Lego special trips and stuff like that, and I can give it to you sealed in box on your desk right now, but the one asterisk would be that you have to build it. And like, I don't want you to like keep it for investment. I don't want you to resell it. Like, I want this to be like something that you're going to enjoy and build. What would it be?
Honestly, the one behind me, that Super Star Destroyer was my dream model. So growing up, I wanted to build one of those. I wanted to build the Titanic too. And I saw that one came out too. I'm like, good. I just had to wait 20 years, but they eventually did it. So I already have the dream Lego set that I wanted. I had to buy that off of eBay. And I actually, when I bought it, I bought two for the explicit reason of saying, like, I know this is going to raise money.
Oh, yeah. It's
it got stolen. The second box never arrived. So I've been stolen in the mail.
Well, so at least I got, you, at least I got the compensated work. For that.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I feel bad for the person who sold it to me on eBay. Cause, I mean,
yeah, they own that buck. But yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, man, like I've had a lot of weird stuff stolen. Legos is one of those things that people don't realize the inherent value they have, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not one to like put them back in the boxes and like put them back in Ziploc bags. I like using them and displaying them, but yeah, exactly. I don't know. I mean, cause I asked that question. I thought it myself. I think maybe one of the sets that I so fondly remember building as a kid that I have a lot of nostalgia in, maybe like the, and they're not big or expensive sets. I could still probably buy them for under $1,000 for a 20-year-old set, which people are like, what? Yeah. And I'm like, no, that's a good price.
That's cheap, yeah.
yeah, so maybe the original Republic gunship that came out in 2004, the original one that came with like two clone troopers and the two superstar, the super battle droids. Maybe the original ARC 170 Starfighter that came out in 2006. These came out as like, you know, $80 and $50 sets respectively. They weren't crazy.
Like I have the original Star Destroyer, the original Death Star, the original TIE Fighter, the original X-Wing and Y-Wing.
Do you plan on getting the Venator?
I have not gotten a Lego set in years. I just haven't had time. And I would love to. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just think at the price it's at and what it is and how it seems like they, you know, obviously, the Lego Star Wars community is very vibrant in their opinions towards the Lego designers, but I think they nailed it, you know? So I'm excited to hopefully get to play with that one. Is there a certain sound that you associate with happiness?
Ooh, with happiness. Yeah, my kids giggle because it's just so like, I don't think children laughter, but my child's. Mm-hmm. Laughter. It's just such a. It's so pure.
Is there a specific child or all three children?
Oh, all three at this point.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. If you had $1 billion that you couldn't spend on yourself or your family, is there a problem that you'd want to solve or want to help start to solve?
Yeah. So there are several. Honestly, world hunger is. Ridiculous. It is a self-inflicted issue. The amount of food thrown out in first world and second world countries and not to third world countries, and it's ridiculous. So there's no reason there should be starving people, even starving people in first world countries, right? Like it makes no sense to me. So there's that. And then the second thing is money in politics. Getting rid of, because it's essentially legal bribery. It's completely utterly corrupting our country. So I would use my money to end the money bribery in politics.
Yeah, I like that, and that's the one thing where it's just like, I think that's getting more and more steam, and more people are becoming aware of that. Like it used to be a thing where no one like talked about it, but nowadays it's becoming like more and more talked about. Where it's just like. There was a reel that went viral, and I guess it was TikTok, and it was a reel, and it was a whatever. It was existed everywhere in the internet as an internet video, and it was the question was, you know, if you could set one law in government, what would the law be? And someone went viral, basically like very eloquently saying that, like, you know, politicians are service jobs. And they are completely barred from making any level of money at any single kind of intersection, basically blocking out any of the current shit that happens right now. And their salaries would be a median or a combination of mean and median average of their constituents in their own district. Right.
Yeah.
And that to me is like brilliant. Like you'd solve a lot of the problems immediately. Most Congress would walk out. Cause I always find it funny, like, and I don't try to keep this podcast as apolitical as possible, but like on both sides of the aisle, and I always find it most ironic with some of the more socialistic leaning members. So like take Elizabeth Warren, for example, being from Massachusetts, I'm very familiar with Elizabeth Warren. You know, she will trumpet from her head about how millionaires are bad and how billion-dollar corporations shouldn't exist and like that. But she has a net worth of, with her husband, of over $70 million,
yeah.
You know? And it's like, it's very weird for you to be like, you know, people should pay more taxes and that, but like, oh, I'm immune because I'm a senator. Yeah. Like, don't include me in that. You know,
yeah,
it's like,
there's just so many things. It's like, how do you go from being a first time congressperson where your net worth is like $150,000, you're taking a job that's $130,000 a year, and your net worth grows to $30 million in 3 years. Like,
yeah, it's insane.
That's called corruption. But again, I'm not needed on the politics. I do want to be conscious of time. I have a meeting in 12 minutes. You're good. So
yeah, I have one last question for you. If you could send a single push notification to everyone's phone in a given area, what would it say and where would you send it?
I kind of really just want to troll people. And so I would go for an area with the maximum density. So it might be LA or New York, probably has the largest density people. Mm-hmm. And I think it would just say O'Doyle rules.
I love that. All right. Is there anything else you want to plug or share, or have the audience check out? I'll link everything below we talked about. I was taking notes the entire time on my phone. But anything else you want?
No, I don't think anything else for the audience. I'd love to talk to you afterwards offline. Obviously, we'll schedule time for later. But
sure.
You know, I can do the typical pitch, like, you know, check us out. We're at Celsi Life on all social media platforms. We're most active on LinkedIn. You can go to our website, celsi.com, and, you know, you can sign up directly to get email updates. We don't spam you. We send email updates maybe once every month and a half to 2 months.
Love that.
And that way you'll be the first to know if we reopen betas or we launch our pre-sales.
Cool. Well, I'll make sure people check it out. And Max, again, thank you for the time. And you and I will chat offline in 2 seconds.
Sounds good. All right. Thanks.
I hope you all enjoyed this conversation between myself and Max. You can find Celsi online, CELCY.com. And as always, you can find me online at Rob Is Lost. I hope you all have a fantastic rest of your day. Goodbye.